reports that Sir Keir Starmer is preparing to announce his resignation, but said the Prime Minister would always act in the national interest. His comments come as Sir Keir faces renewed pressure to set out a timetable for stepping down following Andy Burnham's Labour victory in Makerfield. Our chief political correspondent, Henry Zeffman, says it's a sign that he could resign.
The subtext of that interview was that Sir Keir Starmer is considering resigning. The subtext of that interview, I mean, arguably the text of that interview, was that Keir Starmer's mind has budged over the past couple of days in response to what an extraordinary breadth of Labour MPs I've been speaking to over the past few days believe is simply the inevitable political reality.
The United States and Iran are holding talks in Switzerland today as they try to extend a ceasefire into a long-term peace deal. The American Vice President, J.D. Vance, has said hopes to make progress despite Iran closing the Strait of Hormuz. The Russian authorities in Crimea have suspended private fuel sales as Ukraine steps up attacks on the occupied peninsula. President Zelensky says Ukrainian forces struck fuel facilities in Crimea and southern Russia overnight. Moscow says it shot down 239 Ukrainian drones. A 36-year-old man has been charged in connection with a series of attacks in Edinburgh on Friday. Sir Keir Starmer said the incidents appear to have been motivated by anti-Muslim hatred. The King is to become the first British monarch to make public the amount of tax he pays, following calls for greater transparency after the controversies surrounding Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. The figures will be released on Thursday in a move initiated by the King himself. As the year's longest day got underway, crowds gathered on the seafront in Lowestoft to watch the sunrise. Visitors from across the country travelled to Britain's most easterly point for the annual First Light Festival, which marks the summer solstice. And that's the BBC News at 2 minutes past 12. Now here on Radio 3, it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Ruth Ozeki won the Women's Prize for Fiction in 2022 with her novel The Book of Form and Emptiness. The judges called it a complete joy to read. She's also a filmmaker and a Zen Buddhist priest, and her books draw on her Japanese-American heritage. They also convey her deep concern for our environment, taking on topics such as industrial agriculture, ocean pollution, and mass consumerism. Her most recent book, The Typing Lady and Other Fictions, is her first collection of short stories, and the typing lady of the title has more than a little in common with Ruth herself. Ruth, we're going to listen to Albanith, Pretorius, Benny Goodman, but I think you want to begin with Peter and the Wolf by Prokofiev.
Yes, please. That would be wonderful. It's probably the earliest piece of music that I remember from my childhood.
What is it about the music you think that works its magic?
The narrative is so strong. I think it was the first time that I ever really thought of music as telling a story. And I think it was also the first time that I really listened to the instruments and understood that they all had voices. That really landed with me and enabled me to listen to music in a different way.
Yes, each of the characters has a leitmotif as well as an instrumental colour.
That's right. And I just remember listening. I had an album and I would put it on the record player and listen to the album over and over again and would always be terrified when Grandpapa came in and when I heard the wolf. It was a fully immersive emotional experience for me as a child.
I think you decided to go for the duck.
I did. Now, I mean, the duck, of course, is performed by the oboe. And there was just something about the duck that was so mournful and funny at the same time. And of course, you know, what happens to the duck is a little bit scary. You know, now that I'm talking about it, I'm realizing that I must have imprinted very early on, you know, on this duck, because I realized that this combination of funny and sad is something that I've brought through all of my writing. I actually had never thought about that before, but wow, that's kind of a revelation to me. I remember, too, thinking it was the duck that made me want to play the oboe. And I remember asking my parents if I could take oboe lessons. And my mother, for whatever reason, decided that I was too young to care for a double reed instrument. And so she encouraged me to study the flute instead, which I did. And that was fine. But I've always had an affection for the oboe as a result of this piece of music.
Soon a duck came waddling round. She was glad that Peter had not closed the gate and decided to take a nice swim in the deep pond in the meadow. Settled next to the duck and shrugged her shoulders. "What kind of a bird are you if you can't fly?" said she. To this the duck replied, "Well, what kind of a bird are you if you can't swim?" and dived into the pond. The duck swimming in the pond, the little bird hopping along the shore. Suddenly, something caught Peter's attention. He noticed a cat crawling through the grass. The cat thought, "The bird is busy arguing. I'll just grab her." Peter, and the bird immediately flew up into the tree. While the duck quacked angrily at the cat, from the middle of the pond, and thought, "Is it worth climbing up so high? By the time I get there, the bird will have flown away."
Oh my goodness, I haven't really heard that for a very, very long time. And when Peter just now cried out, "Look out," I jumped in my seat.
And, of course, narrating that was somebody we normally encounter in horror films, Boris Karloff.
Exactly. I mean, his voice is like no other.
The Duck from Peter and the Wolf by Prokofiev, performed by the Vienna State Opera Orchestra and, as I said, narrated by Boris Karloff. Ruth Ozeki, tell me a little bit about your early life. You grew up in New Haven, Connecticut.
Yes, my father taught at Yale University. He was in the anthropology department. And so I grew up very much as a sort of faculty brat on the Yale campus.
But also this wonderful mixture, because your mother, Masako, was Japanese.
That's right, yes. I mean, okay, so there's a kind of a story behind that. My father, as I said, was in the anthropology department at Yale, and many of his colleagues were, you know, at the time, Yale wasn't hiring women, so white male anthropologists were married to Asian wives. And at the time, the wives identified themselves as Oriental. And it was a joke in the department that in order to get tenure in the Yale anthropology department, you had to have an Oriental wife. And it was the wives themselves who told this story and thought it was funny. And so, you know, of course, the offspring, they were mixed race like me, half Asian and half anthropologist. You know, I always felt that this predilection for ethnographic introspection was somehow bred into me from a very early age, that one side of me was always looking at the other and studying the other. It was on the East Coast, of course, so there wasn't a big Asian community there. It was a peculiar place.
And your parents were both linguists.
That's correct, yes. My dad was a linguistic anthropologist. My mother was a linguist who studied the Shanghai dialect. And I think she would have liked to continue teaching, but, you know, this was the 1950s, and generally women, well, certainly my mom anyway, decided that having a family was her priority. But yeah, I was raised by two linguists.
Do you think that informed your early love of language?
Well, I think it did. My father spoke, my goodness, he spoke 7, 8 languages and read many more. My mother spoke several languages too. Her first language had been Japanese. She was born in Japan, raised in Hawaii. She went to Hawaii when she was 6, I think. But Japanese was her first language. When I was a child, she never spoke much Japanese to me at all. I think by then she was more comfortable in English. And well, let's see, I was born in 1956, so this was 11 years after the war. And I think she might have felt, on some level, that learning Japanese might be a handicap for me. And so she never taught me to speak the language. It was something that I very much wanted to learn myself. And so as soon as I entered university, I started to study the language on my own.
I think you first came across the next music at elementary school.
Yes, I went to a really lovely elementary school, and we studied music listening to the Karl Orff curriculum of music education. And so we would listen to the records and we played the xylophones and the glockenspiels and the marimbas and recorders. And it was very much a part of my childhood.
Thank you.
Oh, that's such a treat to hear again.
I can see how that would imprint itself on a child's mind.
Right? Yeah. Listening to this right after listening to the Prokofiev, the Peter and the Wolf, you know, there's something about the way that the instruments build. This piece of music has been used in probably more than one film, but I think the first time I saw it used in a film was Badlands with Sissy Spacek and Martin Sheen, Terrence Malick film. And it was a really beautiful scene. The two of them are very young and they've started on a kind of murder spree. So the music is at once childish and innocent, but it's got this dark underside to it. And the way that the drama of the music builds kind of foreshadows what's going to happen in the film. I think recently when I hear this music, it's always had that kind of sense of slight foreboding mixed in with the, you know, the innocence of it. It's beautiful.
Musica Poetica 1, Gassenhauer, a piece from The Orff Approach, arranged by Gunhild Kietmann and performed by Karl Orff, based on a 16th century lute piece by Hans Neuseller. Ruth Ozeki, you used this music in your 1995 documentary, Harming the Bones. Tell us about the making of that film, because it was based on a real-life event, your grandmother's funeral in Japan.
Yes, that's right. You know, it's a semi-autobiographical film. It's a documentary that strays, shall we say. It was sparked by the death of my grandmother. She died in Japan. And my mother, she wasn't well at the time, and so she asked me to go to Japan in her stead to represent the family. And when we were there, my aunt asked if I wanted to bring some of my grandmother's bones home to my mother. And, you know, of course I said yes, since that seemed to be what was expected. And I remember she took the urn, and I'd never seen remains before, you know, but they were in a beautiful ceramic jar. And she opened the jar and with a pair of chopsticks took out three or four of the bones. And they were large pieces of bone. Apparently in Japan during the cremation, they don't cremate down to the ash. They stop a little bit before that. And so she took out these three pieces of bone and they were very beautiful. They were like coral or something, you know, and they were slightly colored. And she took a Tupperware container and lined it with my grandmother's handkerchief and placed the three pieces of bone in the Tupperware container and handed it to me and said, take these home to your mother. And so I did. I brought them home. I was a little worried going through customs, but I don't think you're allowed to bring cremains through. But in any case, I did. And then for various reasons, my mother didn't seem particularly excited about this. I think perhaps she didn't really know what to do with it. So in any case, the bones sat on a shelf in my closet, probably for over a year. And it was really like having a skeleton in my closet, literally. And I decided I needed to create the occasion for me to deliver the bones to my mother. So I did. I made a film about it, and I figured that would force me to do it. And so that's what the film is. It's a film about me delivering my grandmother's bones to my mother and incorporating a lot of the family history within that framework. And the film is called Having the Bones.
The film's also a moving exploration of identity, what it's like to live between two cultures. How did that feel growing up?
Well, it was something that, I mean, I was aware of the fact that I was different from a fairly early age, and I didn't quite know what to make of that. You know, I was perceived as being Asian, other, different from everyone else. And so I started to think of myself that way, too. I identified as a Japanese girl, which meant that I kind of took on all of the stereotypes. You know, there were certain things that a Japanese girl should be. We should be quiet and well-mannered and good at, you know,
decorous.
Yes, that's right. Good at school, you know, studious. We could play an instrument. That was fine. There were certain things we could not be. One of them was funny. You know, that was not part of the identity. And it really wasn't until I went to Japan for the first time, people looked at me as being a white American, right? And it was such a liberating feeling because I suddenly realized that that was also part of my identity, that I could be loud and I could be funny and I could be crass and I could be all of these other things that, you know, that I'd never been allowed to be before. And so there was a sense of completion there that was really quite liberating.
Let's turn just for a moment away from your mother, because I think this next piece reminds you more of your father.
Yes, my father loved music, and when he was, I think, probably in his 50s, he took up classical guitar. So that was also part of the soundtrack of my childhood. Wow.
You know, you were talking about being in two different worlds, and that music wasn't originally composed for guitar. That's an arrangement. But it sounds so naturally guitaristic, if I could use that
word. Does. It really does. Now, I have to say that my dad, that was an aspirational piece. He never actually played that himself, but he used to play the recording. I think this was the John Williams recording.
Asturias from the Spanish Suite No. 1, arranged for guitar and composed by Isaac Albéniz, performed, as you said, by John Williams. Yeah. Ruth, what were you like as a child then, apart from feeling a bit pulled in two directions?
Well, I remember having a very happy childhood. I was very fortunate. My parents certainly encouraged me to play music. I studied the piano, I studied the flute. I had a best friend, and we were, I think, very precocious, and we were very dramatic young girls.
One of the stories in your
exactly. I was just thinking that. There's a story in the collection called Feelings, and it's a story of two very precocious, very dramatic young girls, and the way that they, you know, there was just something about the intense friendships that young girls form. And we used to play all the time and make up these really fantastic stories about the world and about other people. And we were almost practicing emotions. It's a time of life when you have an emotional range, but you don't quite know what to do with those emotions. And also the emotions are kind of wildly inaccurate in a way as well. You know, you think you know how the world is, how somebody else might feel. But in fact, you don't really have the ability to put yourself in someone else's shoes and understand what their life is like.
I think your flute teacher once tricked you into a performance on the piccolo.
That's right. That's right. So my friend Jane and I were both studying the flute, and we were wildly in love with playing, practicing. And I continued to play the flute through high school. Flute was my instrument, not piccolo, but my flute teacher suddenly decided that I should learn to play the piccolo. So he would lend me his piccolo, and he had me play a piece that was used as the opening for the Barnum and Bailey Circus. He, along with some of his friends from Boston Symphony, would go play with Barnum and Bailey when the circus came to town, when they came to Boston. So I thought that was fun, and he invited me to come to a circus performance, and I did. He said, come to the orchestra pit, so I did. And the musicians had quite a bit to drink by then, it seems. And, you know, the circus hadn't started yet. And he suddenly told me that he had to use the toilet. And he handed me the piccolo and he disappeared. So I'm standing there talking to the other musicians. And suddenly the cue came to start. And the piccolo leads off in that arrangement. And my flute teacher was nowhere to be seen. And so his friend said, well, do you know the piece? You have to do it. Right. And so I did. I sat down and played the opening of that piece. And when it was over, I turned around and my flute teacher was standing behind just laughing. He just thought this was the funniest thing. So that was really the highlight of my music career, performance wise.
Well, it's actually a flute piece that I think you've chosen next.
Yes.
With the great French flautist Jean-Pierre Rampal and the composer Francis Poulenc.
Yes.
And rather wonderful to be able to hear them playing together. What do you love about this?
Well, again, this was really an aspirational piece. And I remember my friend and I were so excited when we were allowed to practice this. We were crazy about Rampal in the way that only teenage girls can be. We thought that he was just the cat's meow.
Thank you.
Oh, amazing.
The first movement of the Sonata for Flute and Piano by Francis Poulenc, who played the piano on that recording with the flautist Jean-Pierre Rampal. Ruth Ozeki, you studied English and Asian studies at university and then in the early 1980s went on to study classical Japanese literature at Nara Women's University in Japan. What was it like moving there?
Well, it was really a time when I was trying to explore in more depth that side of my heritage. I really wanted to be a Shakespeare scholar. That was my first love. And at the time, this was in the late 70s, early 80s, my professors were not, it sounds very racist, and in fact it is racist, but people like me weren't really encouraged to become Shakespeare scholars. And my professors said, well, you know, you're, you know, you have these two heritages. Why don't you do comparative literature? And it seemed like a good idea at the time. And so I was studying Japanese no drama, the chanting and the dance itself, the form of theater where the actors wear those beautiful masks. And it was a wonderful time. It somehow convinced me, too, that I didn't want to go into academia. You know, there were other things that were more interesting to me.
During those years in Japan, you also worked in Kyoto's entertainment or water district, didn't you, as a bar hostess?
Yes, I did. You can see why I didn't go into academia.
I wonder what that involved.
Well, it's not something I would encourage young girls to do now, certainly. But at the time, I was doing this with a friend. We had decided that we wanted to travel through Southeast Asia. That was a quick way to make money. And so we were hired at a bar called Kingu Joji Yonsei, which means King George the Fourth. And so our job was to basically dress nicely and to show up at around 10 o'clock at night and pour drinks and sit with and chat with mostly businessmen who were coming in. It wasn't just businessmen, though. There were a lot of university professors who came to the bar, a lot of, you know, company CEOs, but also a lot of the abbots of the local Kyoto Zen temples would very often come and bring their young priests and get them drunk. You know, we had the chance to converse with a wide range of people. And it's really where I learned to speak Japanese, was in the bar.
It's Pretorius next, Michael Pretorius, whose music features in one wonderful story in your latest collection. It's called the story Leaf Blower. Tell us about the characters in this.
Yes, it's a story about a young woman who has just graduated from a Master's of Fine Arts in poetry and finds herself pretty much unemployable. And she rents an apartment over a garage that's owned by a professor and his wife, who has Alzheimer's, being a kind of caretaker for this elderly couple. The professor is really bothered by the sound of the lawn maintenance equipment, in particular a leaf blower, constantly being used.
It's a monstrous noise.
It's a monstrous noise. And I have to say, this story very much comes from my loathing of that particular piece of lawn maintenance equipment.
Ditto.
Yeah. We'll listen to the music, but
They use the music to drown out the sound.
Exactly. The older instruments have a particular frequency that drown out the sound of the leaf blower.
Yes, I loved this line, cocooned in 16th century harmonies and buffered by crumb horns and shawms, kirtles and rackets. The professor no longer frets about the noise outside.
That's right. It's the crumb horn in particular that has a certain frequency that competes successfully with the leaf blower.
Thank you.
You can hear how, you know, that would very successfully compete with a leaf blower or a hedge trimmer.
Absolutely. And also had that oft kind of fun about it.
Yes, yes, you're right. I'm really beginning to see through lines here. Yeah.
Branal de la Toche from the Dances from Terpsichore, composed by Praetorius and performed by the New London Consort. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the novelist, filmmaker and Zen Buddhist priest, Ruth Ozeki. Ruth, you moved back to New York in 1985, and for the next 10 years were working on films. How did you first get involved in that?
Well, there wasn't a great demand for people with my particular set of skills at the time, but I had friends who were in the film business. And I'd actually been interested in film, and so I got a job working on a film set in the art department. The film was called Matt Riker Mutant Hunt, and it was a very, very, very low-budget horror film. And about a week or so before filming was to start, the director suddenly remembered that they hadn't hired an art director. And he looked around, and I was the only person at the table who wasn't doing anything. And so he pointed at me, and he said, you be the art director. Now, I had never set foot on a film set before, and I had no idea what an art director did. But that didn't seem to bother him at all. And he said, don't worry, we will tell you what to do. And they did. So yes, I art directed that film and then went on to art direct and production design several more equally bad films. Let's see now. Breeders was one of them. Robot Holocaust was another. Necropolis was yet another. I was going to say it was fun. Was it fun? It was interesting work. But from there, I ended up sort of moving into doing work with Japanese media at a time when, the Japanese yen was very strong. There were a lot of film and television productions and commercial productions coming to New York. And so I found a place in that world because I could speak Japanese and worked for Japanese television for several years.
Do you think that these early experiences of filmmaking in any way informed the way you write?
Oh, very much so. Yes, very much so. I ended up doing directing, and as a director, I would edit my pieces as well. And that's really where I learned to tell a story. I had tried to write several novels, and I would always get bogged down in trying to move a story through its chronology, move a story along in time. And it was in the editing room, editing video. That's where I learned to do that. So that was one thing. And I think the other way that it was very influential was that I started to be able to visualize stories. It wasn't language, it was language and image. I still do this. When I'm writing a scene, I almost enter the scene as a camera, walk into a room in my imagination, and look around the way that you would look around if you were holding a camera, and sort of settle on a frame and start to write from there. That visual training was incredibly helpful.
It's an aria from La Traviata next.
Yes, that's right. Again, my father loved opera, and so I grew up listening to opera, and this was the first one that I ever went to see at the Met.
Thank you.
It just makes me want to weep.
I think it was Thomas Mann who said about Verdi that he could actually turn moments of great tragedy into a triumph of idealism and the human spirit. And that certainly was the case there, wasn't it?
Oh, my goodness, it really is. I'm quite choked up. I think that was Montserrat Caballé singing in that performance, yeah?
That's right. Addio del passato from Verdi's La Traviata. With the RCA Italiana Orchestra, conducted by Georges Prêtre.
She was who I saw perform at the Met. I think she performed the role for 2 years, in 1967, 1968, something like that. And that was a performance that I saw.
Ruth Ozeki, your first novel in 1998, My Year of Meats, tackled food politics early on and made quite an impression.
You know, when I wrote that, my initial intention was to talk about television and to talk about commercial media and how television presents a certain picture of the world that perhaps is not quite accurate. And, you know, I had been involved in commercial TV for many years by that point. So this was something that I was very aware of, you know, how the corporate sponsorship message really impacted the way that we were telling stories. I had had experience producing programs for a variety of rather nefarious corporate entities. One of the programs, it was a cultural program. It was a wonderful show, but it was sponsored by Philip Morris. And this was at a time when I myself was desperately trying to quit smoking. And we had a requirement in every show to show some young, healthy, beautiful person smoking a Philip Morris product. So one of the jobs I had was to go out onto the street with pockets full of cigarettes and lighters and stop people and ask them if they would mind smoking so we could film them. And the sort of hypocrisy behind this obviously did not escape me. And so this was something that bothered me. Another sponsor for another program that I ended up writing about in my Year of Meats was the meat industry. And I knew very well the sort of ecological impact of large-scale factory farming. We all knew about this. It's not a big secret. And yet at the same time, we were, you know, making programs that celebrated consumption of meat. And there's nothing wrong with eating meat. I eat meat myself. But it was more just the way that we were not dealing with, not really thinking about that aspect of the work that we were doing. And so the novel was about that. It was about the kinds of compromises that we make in the workplace, why we make those kinds of compromises, and the long-term effects of that kind of ethical
dilemma,
yeah.
Social and political issues are clearly important in your writing, but do you think writing can actually change things?
You know, when I'm writing, I don't really have an activist stance. I don't know whether writing can change anything. What it can do is it can help me learn more. And it takes me a long time to write books because I do end up doing quite a bit of research. These issues bother me. I want to learn more about them. And so the way for me to do that is to turn it into a project, kind of investigate it from the inside rather than from the outside.
Well, the next piece of music actually has an environmental theme.
This is the Sigur Rós. I suppose it is an environmental theme. I am not even going to try to pronounce this. The English translation is the fly savior or the fly freer. How's your Icelandic?
Yes, it's about a man who tries to save flies from a river before they're eaten by baby salmon.
That's
and
right.
He falls into the river and almost drowns, manages to save himself, then goes back into the water to try again. And there's something about the futility of the man's determined and foolish compassion that is moving.
That's right. And I think that it's an attitude that I feel I understand. You know, in some way, our attempts to rectify situations, they don't always pan out, you know, and yet we still have to keep trying. There's something quite noble about that.
The Fly Saviour, composed by the Icelandic band Sigur Rós and performed in the instrumental version there by the Kronos Quartet. Ruth Ozeki, tell us now about Zen Buddhism and what initially drew you to it.
Well, my very first memory as a little tiny person was the image of my grandfather sitting Zen meditation, sitting Zazen. He and my grandmother had come from Hawaii to visit us before moving back to Japan. And they must have arrived late at night. And in the morning, I woke up, I remember, and my mother told me to go call them for breakfast. And they were sleeping in my parents' bedroom, which in itself was a big deal because they must be very powerful people to displace my parents from their bedroom. And so I was very impressed and filled with a certain amount of trepidation. And my memory is just of reaching up to the doorknob and turning the doorknob and opening it and looking into the room and seeing my grandfather sitting on the floor cross-legged, and he was rocking gently from side to side. And he opened his eyes and we made eye contact. And what was astonishing about this was that we were the same level. Right. Our eyes were on the same level because he was sitting on the floor. And you're not used to that. I wasn't used to that. I also wasn't used to adults sitting on the floor. That seemed very odd to me. But there was this moment of making eye contact that really sort of impressed me. And I think I must have gone running out to the kitchen to find my mother to tell her what I'd seen. And she explained to me that he was doing some breathing exercises or something like that. But in any case, I probably imprinted on that somewhat because I was always interested in meditation. Now, of course, this was the 60s and everyone was interested in meditation. But I remember trying to meditate probably around 7 or 8 or something. And I remember sitting cross-legged on the floor in my bedroom with a candle. I must have swiped a candle from the drawer and staring at the candle and thinking, look at me, you know, here I am, I'm meditating. And then that interest kind of continued for me. But, you know, I didn't really get serious about it until I was in my late 30s. By that point, my parents were in ill health. You know, it was clear that they were reaching the ends of their lives. And my father, in fact, had a very serious heart attack. And so I'm an only child, and caring for them really fell to me. And I really was not prepared for this. It was very difficult. My mother also had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And that's when I really started taking Buddhism very seriously. I think I understood then that I needed help. I needed to develop some kind of strength. I needed a backbone. And this was a way to do it. It was also a way to learn to tolerate my own distress and the sort of panic of my mind. And it was probably around that time, too, that I met Norman Fisher, who became my Zen teacher. And, you know, once I started sitting and studying Zen with Norman, I never really went back. It became the heart and one of the pillars of my life. Because of that, I decided that I would like to sort of help with the transmission of Zen and teaching and sort of passing it on. And so that's why I asked for ordination.
What would you say to people who are listening and would like to get into meditation but find it hard? Are there any things you say which could ease their way in?
Well, we have a preconception in the West that meditation is about emptying your mind or finding peace or finding equanimity. And most of us, when we start sitting, it is not an equanimous feeling to be sitting alone in a room in silence, holding still, being alone with your mind. Our minds are, you know, meant to think. So this idea of emptying the mind is misleading and it scares people off. So I think it's more about becoming friendly with your mind and becoming comfortable with the way your mind operates. When I teach meditation, I teach it very much as a physical, almost a yogic practice. It's about sitting still and really becoming aware of your body and becoming aware of your senses and becoming aware of the world sort of moving in and out of your experience. And I usually teach it with the object of meditation being the breath But if your mind strays, then that's fine. You know, minds are meant to think. And so there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing unusual. At some point, you'll notice that your mind is strayed and you're worrying about what to have for dinner or you're worrying about something you said in an email. And you'll notice that. And then that will remind you, oh, right, I'm meditating. And then you bring your awareness back to your breath and continue. This happens, you know, hundreds of times, thousands of times, you know, you stray and then you come back and you stray and you come back. And so really the meditation ends up being a practice of return. You're coming back to yourself over and over and over again. And this is a very useful skill for anyone, but I think particularly for writers. You know, one of the things that we struggle with, you know, we're facing an empty page and it's uncomfortable, but to be able to develop a tolerance, you know, it's just funny when you think about it. You know, our minds are funny, right? And the problems that we create are for ourselves are pretty funny. And I think meditation can teach you that. You know, it's like, oh, right, that again. You know, and so that's what I mean when I say friendliness. I think you develop an attitude of fondness for some of the strange ways that the mind works. You stop thinking that that's a problem.
That's interesting, yeah. Because your work so often explores the idea of attention and presence.
Yeah. And I think that's just kind of a byproduct of, you know, the many, many hours I've spent meditating.
Spanish music next, Ruth. It's Esteban Garza.
Yes, yes. In college. I mean, obviously, there's a tie here from my dad's love of classical guitar and particularly Spanish guitar. But I just started to listen to a lot of Spanish Renaissance music in college. So when I hear this now, it brings me back to that period in my life. You know, those college years are very powerful. And when I was writing a story for this collection called One Art, it's about really like a first love. I thought, well, I really need to listen to more Spanish Renaissance music to try to understand and to try to remember what it felt like to be 20 years old and in love.
Thank you.
What happened to you, Shepherd Juan Pastor, so depressed when you used to be so happy? Performed by Shirley Ramsey.
It's the perfect lyrics for that particular age, right?
Yes. We all know it.
We all know it. We all know it.
How important is the art of listening to your writing? The Book of Form and Emptiness won the Women's Prize for Fiction in 2022, for example. It's about a young boy called Benny who, after his father's death, hears objects speaking.
Yes, Benny has supernatural ears, you know, and he can hear the voices of things, of objects in the world around him, speaking to him. It's something that I think about, you know, a lot, because objects have stories. And when you start thinking about what goes into, say, making an athletic shoe, and all of the people who have been involved in the manufacture of that athletic shoe and growing of the cotton to make the body of the shoe and the production of rubber and the, you know, the grommets. If all of the ghosts of all of the people who were involved in the designing and the making and the shipping and the selling of that shoe were somehow attached to the object, right, it would be a very crowded place indeed. And it changes the way that you interact with the world. And I think that that's what Benny experiences. He is aware of the people working in the factory. He can see them. He can hear them.
Benny hears his dead father's voice. Was that something that happened to you?
Yes, it was, in fact. After my dad died, it probably lasted for about a year after he died, I would be doing something, you know, very ordinary, like folding the laundry or making my bed. And he was always standing slightly behind me on the right side, and I would hear him clear his throat. And then he would just say my name, Ruth, you know. And it was so clear. I remember I would just turn around and fully expect to see him. And of course, he wouldn't be there. And every time this happened, you know, it was, again, just kind of being hit with the fact of his absence and the sadness that came along with that. And then later I discovered, too, that it was actually quite common, you know, that many people hear voices of many different kinds. And certainly after the death of someone you love.
Tell me a little bit more about the concept of emptiness in the Book of Form and Emptiness, because in Japan it has a richer meaning, doesn't it?
Yes, it's a Buddhist term. It sounds very bleak, doesn't it? Emptiness. It sounds very empty, but it's really not. And the way that I like to describe it is to use the metaphor of a wave. When we're looking at the ocean, a wave will start to form out of this big, vast, empty ocean, right? Looking at it from the point of view of the wave, you know, the wave is getting taller and taller. And at some point it looks around and thinks, look at me, like I am something, right? I am a wave. I'm taller than the rest of all of this empty ocean around me. I have my little white cap on my head. You know, I'm special. And, you know, I like it here. I like being a wave. And then, of course, as soon as the wave starts to think that, you know, the winds blow and the planet turns and the tides shift and suddenly the wave starts to get smaller and smaller. And the wave doesn't like that. You know, the wave wants to continue to be a wave. And then before you know it, it's like, oh, no, you know, and the wave is back to being part of the ocean again. And I think that's a nice way of conceiving of this notion of emptiness, you know, that we're all just like these little waves, and we like being waves, and we want to persist, but sadly we won't.
Jazz was important in that book too, as Benny's dad Kenji was a jazz clarinetist.
That's right. I listened to a lot of Benny Goodman while I was writing that book.
There's a very touching moment where his bandmates come and play at his cremation. Yeah. The drummer marks a tempo, but there is silence where his clarinet solo should be, or we could say emptiness.
Yes, yes, that's right.
It's jazz next, isn't it? What have you chosen?
I've chosen Sing, Sing, Sing with a Swing by Benny Goodman.
Thank you.
That's wonderful.
Sing, Sing, Sing with a Swing, composed by Louis Prima and performed by the Benny Goodman Big Band. Ruth, your latest collection, The Typing Lady and Other Fictions, has a typewriter on the cover and features typewriters in many of the stories. What is it about typewriters that you so love?
What is it about typewriters? I grew up with the sound of typewriters as part of the soundtrack of my childhood. I remember my parents letting me use their typewriters and the thrill of that, you know, of being able to operate this mechanical piece of equipment that would make stories, you know. I'm not even sure what happened, but a couple of years ago, it was right around the time that ChatGPT was launched. And I just felt a sense of, like, wow, progress. You know, it's just too much for me. I think I've had it. You guys can go on ahead, but I think I'm going back to the 20th century. Of course, I was joking because I like RNA vaccines. You know, there's many things about progress that I appreciate. But there was a sense that it was all just getting to be too much. And sometime right around then, I happened to drive past a typewriter store in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I pulled over and I went in. And the owner came out from the back, and there were just rows and rows and rows of typewriters. And he told me, you know, try any one that you'd like. And he gave me a stack of paper and cleared a little bit of a desk. And at that point, time kind of stopped. I just know that I came out several hours later with a 1956 Smith Corona. And that was really the beginning. I just got the bug. And before I knew it, I was collecting typewriters and then learning how to fix them and clean them.
The 11 stories in the book embrace different stages in life, from childhood through midlife to old age. As a writer, how do you think your perspective has changed over time?
Tremendously. I like getting older. You know, I like it because it changes the past. Things that I had never understood from my childhood, for example, come into a different kind of focus. So for me, the aging process is really one of discovery, and it's really exciting to me.
You teach creative writing, and I wondered, do you start people on short stories, or what's the thing that you most frequently say to young writers?
The thing I say most frequently is really just write if you love to write and don't think about publication. That's putting the cart before the horse. It's something that you do because you love doing it. Either you love moving commas around or you don't. And it seems to me that so many people want to be writers. You know, they want to have written, but the actual process of writing is something that they resist. And I understand that. I mean, I resist it too, you know. I'm as impatient as anybody. But when I actually get into it, working on the sentences, that to me is just the most joyful thing.
Well, we've come to the final sentence in our literary musico session, Ruth. So tell me about the final track.
This must be Time Has Told Me by Nick Drake. And it's a song that is very beautiful, and it's about time, and it's about perspective, and in my mind, it's always about mortality. I listened to a lot of Nick Drake when I was writing A Tale for the Time Being.
Ruth Ozeki, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure.
Time has told me you're rare, fine. Trouble cure for a troubled mind. Time has told me not to ask for more. Someday our ocean will find its shore. So I'll leave the ways that are making me be what I really don't want to be. Leave the ways that are making me love what I really don't want to love. Time has told me you came with the dawn. A soul with no footprint, a rose with no thorn. Your tears, they tell me there's really no way of ending your troubles with things you can say. Time will tell you by my side, to keep on trying till there's no more to hide. So leave the ways that are making you be what you really don't want to be. Leave the ways that are making you love what you really don't want to love. Time has told me you're rare, fine. Trouble cure trouble mine. Time has told me not to ask for more. For someday our ocean will find.
Time Has Told Me, composed and performed by Nick Drake. The final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the writer Ruth Ozeki. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael's guest will be the writer and former Royal Air Force navigator, John Nicol.
Radio 3 in concert.
World-class performances from a world-class venue.
Snape Maltings in Suffolk. This year's Aldborough Festival marks 50 years since the death of Benjamin Britten, with the Britten Sinfonia, the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, and the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. And soloists including Laura van der Heyden, Colin Curry, and Stephen Osborne, playing works by Shostakovich, Ravel, and Britten himself. Radio 3 in concert at the Aldborough Festival continues tomorrow evening from 7:30. Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
You are listening to BBC Radio 3. Hello from me, Jane Royce. It's coming up to 1:30, so it's time for Music Map on this, the longest day of the year. This week, we're travelling to Sweden, where the summer solstice sun barely dips below the horizon. Sarah Moore-Peach is marking this by navigating the musical landscape of Ugo Alvén's Midsummer Vigil.
Hello and welcome to Radio 3's Music Map. You're going to want to make yourself a garland of flowers, grab a schnapps and a plate of herring and potato salad, and stay up all night for this one. It's the Midsummer Vigil by the Swedish composer Ugo Alvén. And this is the piece that we're exploring today, creating a map of musical connections that'll lead us towards our destination. A joyful classic that weaves Swedish folk tunes into an orchestral fantasy celebrating the traditions of the land of the midnight sun. Stay tuned for more midsummer tunes, a little light espionage, and loads more Swedish music, including ABBA. Plus, the actual folk tunes that Alvén based his piece on. He wrote it in 1903, the same year that Maurice Ravel wrote this.